buried, which in turn contributes to the solidification of the sand near the plant. Every natural NEPCA vase is named according to the species it hosts. The NEPCAs are called talagaz or talatog by the locals in this region. Another unique feature of Lut are these same NEPCAs. They are the tallest natural vases in the world. The NEPCAs of this kind have been seen in Africa too, but the ones in Africa are barely 3 meters tall. At their tallest, the NEPCAs in Iran are 10 meters tall. Normally, NEPCAs grow on flat surfaces. They best grow on moist land. The shape of the NEPCA depends on the size, density, and growth rate of the host plant. In this NEPCA forest, the dominant species is the salt cedar. My goodness, it looks more like a miracle. Just look how God instilled the hope for life in these salt cedars and saxoles. When they're just small seedlings, winds dump massive amounts of sand onto them. But driven by their strong will to live, they continue to grow in order to survive. The battle between the wind and sand on one hand and these trees on the other has been going on forever. It's been around for millions of years. But what is really very important is that hope keeps everything and everyone alive. And these trees, because of their intrinsic sense of hope, the will for life, put their roots down and stand tall. They continue to grow as a means of survival. It's going to become stormy very soon. Desert storms are very dangerous. So what you need to do is find shelter somewhere or leave that area immediately. Fortunately, I'm very close to my next destination and I think I'm not going to run into any trouble. But I have to get going immediately or I'm going to get sand and dirt all over my body and stuff. My camera crew and I were taken off guard by the sudden change of weather and the subsequent sandstorm. One of the biggest powers of nature in a desert is the ability of sand and dust to penetrate each and every orifice during a storm, and our equipment was no exception. Sandstorms are among the biggest dangers of a desert. In some cases, such storms continue to blow for days and can cost nature travelers their lives. But there are other dangers lurking in other parts of this vast plain. Therefore, the best way to ensure a safe trip to Lut is to make the necessary arrangements with the relevant authorities in Kerman province and the city of Shahdad. From Shahdad, I had to walk around 250 kilometers to the west of the province, to a place only 15 kilometers away from Rafsanjan. Kerman is a province with limited water resources. Many of the deep wells in the province have dried up. But deep in the heart of Rafsanjan's crisis-hit nature, there is a canyon that sparkles like a diamond. You might be thinking this isn't Iran, that I'm speaking to you from another country. But you're wrong. This is our beloved Iran, and I'm now standing atop a scary deep canyon, the Raga Grand Canyon of Rafsanjan. Valleys and canyons are strange yet beautiful natural phenomena, and they become even more beautiful if their emergence is not the result of orogeny, rather if it's the result of thousands or millions of years of erosion by wind, sand, and water of flat plains. Raga Grand Canyon is one such ravine, a peerless, pristine valley in Kerman Province. I was amazed at the view of the canyon from above. The pointed cones, the big and small columns carved out by erosion, the arcs, the partitions and wall-like strips were only a few of all the beautiful features of this canyon. Raga is around 20 kilometers long. Its width varies between 3 and 100 kilometers, and in some places it is around 80 meters deep. Walking on top of it could have been very dangerous. My goodness, it's really scary, but it's magnificent at the same time. At this point, I think it's around 70 meters deep from where I'm standing. If I fall into it, there will be nothing left of me. It's dangerous to be here because the earth here is very soft and can slide at any moment. So you'll have to keep a safe distance while walking along these beautiful walls. It's ruggedly beautiful indeed. You can get the most beautiful view of the canyon from up here, but every side of it offers its own unique beauty. What I'm really happy about is the fact that there is no construction work happening anywhere in a 20-kilometer radius. There are no roads. That's why this ravine has maintained its pristine status, and of course, the area around it too. My hope is that we can preserve this untouched ravine and its surroundings the way they are and leave them to the next generation, and they to the generation that comes after them, just like the way it looks now. I hope so. The canyon's geomorphology and its pristine environs made for beautiful scenery, and that had provided a good habitat for certain species of animals in and around it. This region and this gorge are so intact, they have become home to various species of birds, such as eagles that have built their nests in recesses high on the walls where they feel safe. I'm very excited and counting every minute for the walk on the bed of the canyon, but the best time to do it will be tomorrow because I don't have enough time for it today. Raga Canyon is a good destination for geologists and nature travelers venturing into the Lute. The vegetation, such as salt cedar trees in some parts of the canyon, made the canyon even more beautiful. From the bottom up, ravines look just as beautiful. I walked along much of Raga Canyon from above and captured many beautiful views of it, but it was now time to go down to the bottom of it. This part of the wall is solid. It's hard to walk on. It's very steep too, as you can see. You have to take a lot of care going down. My God, yes! At the bottom, the canyon was beautiful and scary. I kept thinking its walls were going to come crashing down any minute. Walking at the foot of those majestic walls, I felt how little and weak I was compared to the canyon and to its creator. On one hand, the beautiful long natural statues, and on the other, the tunnel-shaped arcs carved into the walls were all astonishing. Statues chiseled by gravity pulling down the dirt and pebbles on the walls of the ravine. The view down here is simply breathtaking. The huge, majestic statues carved out on the walls of the canyon have taken thousands of years to be made. As loose earth from the top of the canyon cascaded down to the bottom over the years, it created these beautiful shapes on these walls. They are stunning. Some of them look like humans and others like certain animals. Ravine exploration is among the most interesting fields in nature traveling. There are many adventurers around the world who are in love with exploring valleys and canyons. But this field of sport comes with its own hidden dangers. The collapse of the walls or falling from the edge of a canyon's walls are among those dangers. But there's another more serious threat to the life of nature travelers, which is seasonal floodwaters caused by rainfall. Just take a look at what seasonal rivers have done to these walls. The water can be around 2 meters deep here at the time of a flood and can be fatal. Whenever I travel to a place like this, I study up on its weather and climate before I set out so I won't run into any trouble. So when it's raining, you better not be anywhere near the bottom of any ravine. Although Raga Canyon is very wide and the floodwaters flowing in pose a less serious threat, it is likely for torrential rain to come down in the nearby areas. And that means flash floods at a certain time during a day or night or a whole day. So at a time like that, you better not come here. Most nature travelers take all kinds of precautions prior to their adventure. But most of them don't pay much attention to the climate of the places they travel to. They don't take the weather forecasts very seriously. In 2005, 11 mountaineers from Razvin, with all their equipment and years of experience, entered Andres Canyon in Alborz province. But because they had ignored the weather forecast and the predicted rain, they had an accident. During rainfalls, valleys and canyons that offer no escapes are the most dangerous places in the natural world to be. In that year, heavy rain set off floodwaters in Andres Canyon, and unfortunately, it took the lives of all 11 mountaineers. Therefore, the most important thing that natural explorers should take into account is the weather forecast, the difficulty of the route they're traveling on, and their mental and physical strength for the trip ahead. You can't put a price tag on the environment. All those who walk into nature speak of it as a cathartic experience and absorb massive amounts of positive energy. In my opinion, because the natural world is a manifestation of the greatness and beauty of God, I have walked a very long distance. I'm about to arrive at the end of the canyon. I'm going to have to get out of it before dark sets in, concluding another leg of my trip. It's very easy to pollute your environment, but that's not right. It only goes to show how irresponsible we humans can be. We have to take responsibility for the environment in our country and in the entire planet. We mustn't dump our garbage out in the open and instead send it to the recycling system. We must treat nature the same way we do our homes. Only then can we say we are committed to other humans, to the planet Earth, and to future generations. I'm approaching the end of my trip. I have no doubt that many of my countrymen and women are not familiar with the beautiful natural wonders of Kerman province. And many of the officials in the province don't seem to be aware of the great potential these natural wonders have as tourist destinations. In addition to its old history and culture, the province boasts unique natural features on a par with their counterparts in the rest of the world. In the developed world, development doesn't include building roads, hotels, and tourism centers in the heart of the environment. In the century we live in, development and progress is tantamount to the unconditional and responsible preservation of the environment, and sustainable development of the tourism industry can easily set in motion the big wheels of the country's economy. The environment in Iran is very fragile and sensitive, but with proper professional preservation and protection by people and officials alike, it can turn into a big generator of jobs and revenues, provided that we appreciate what we have and do all we can to preserve what's left of Iran's untapped natural world. We should perish the thought of construction on it.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that Iran's deserts, with their varied and dramatic landscapes of canyons, yardangs, and their beautiful flora and fauna, are a unique destination for the demanding traveler to discover a wealth of exceptional and unspoiled views. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Innovative solutions to lack of access to technology and the internet will require to make online learning work, says Sarah Berry, researcher, in an article published under the heading, What Pandemic Has Taught Us About Education Technology. Stay tuned for more. The pandemic has brought havoc into the lives of many, personally and professionally. Loss of lives, lifestyles, jobs, routines, rhythms, and with it all, so much more. The list is endless. The domain of education is no different. Where education imparted in schools was heavily dependent on human interaction, it shifted to a situation where a fine balance was maintained between human and tech intervention, to a situation where education technology became a must. This domain has indeed witnessed a paradigm shift. According to the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, the COVID-19 pandemic has led to the closure of schools in 188 countries, affecting more than 1.5 billion students and 63 million primary and secondary teachers worldwide. These are mind-boggling figures, and the question that pops up spontaneously is how diverse stakeholders in the domain of education have coped with the loss of jobs, the shift to online teachings and learning, conducting and appearing for exams, maintaining interaction with peers during lockdowns and thereafter, while maintaining social distancing, adjusting to designing and delivering curricula, and so much more. One acknowledged fact, however, remains. Access to the required tech equipment, stable internet connections, and consistent electricity supply was necessary for the smooth and regular conduct of online classes. According to McKinsey, India had 560 million internet subscribers in September 2018, second only to China. Indians download more apps, 12.3 billion in 2018, than any other country except China, and spend more time on social media, an average of 17 hours a week, than social media users in China and the United States. On the other hand, India's digital divide remains huge, as more than 400 million people still have no access to the internet. Divide is also huge, with the internet density in rural areas, where more than 60% of the people live. It is still low at 25% compared with the internet density in urban areas, that is about 90%. The digital divide is also big across the leading and lagging regions, with states like Bihar and Uttar Pradesh with very low internet use density. General digital divide is also huge within India, with far fewer women with access to mobile phones and the internet services. The pandemic has also served as an opportunity to rethink challenges in order to find innovative and customized solutions. So, if electricity supply and internet access are erratic, and/or if the target audience has limited or no access to smartphone, how can regularity in education be ensured? One solution that emerged in India, for example, was dissemination via IVR, that is, interactive voice response, which found resonance despite initial hiccups. In situations where even this was not possible, dissemination of education while maintaining social distancing was implemented once the lockdown was eased. In either case, it was not a substitute for the regular bricks and mortar model, but what did happen was that the link with formal education was not completely broken. A 14-year-old pupil remarked, "I didn't have consistent access to smartphone once the lockdown eased and my parents resumed work, but what worked for me were fixed hours during which the phone was with me, and I could take instructions from my teachers and discuss the work given prior and which I had attempt subsequently." Another young student residing in an urban slum couldn't attend regular online classes but found a way of joining one of her fellow students a few houses away where internet connectivity was more stable. at the end of the day, it also depends on how committed one is to complete one's education or, in other words, remain in touch with what's happening in the virtual classroom, she said. We even discuss problems and solutions in a common WhatsApp group. These challenges were not limited to the classroom and studies only, but also other mental and emotional issues. We all became like an extended family. What also needs to be understood is that designing and imparting of curricula need to be fine-tuned. One size does not fit all, especially in an extremely diverse country. So how does one address this? A life and soft skills trainer reminisced about one of her online batches. At the beginning, I was nervous. I am a technically challenged person. I hadn't met any batch personally, and I had to teach them verbal English communication skills. I took it step by step. I learned what I could be beforehand in terms of technicalities. Some I learned during my journey with the help of my students and with others. We, my students and I, jointly found a solution to. The idea is not to know everything. One can't. Just accept that. What I ensured was that the video option was on and the sessions were heavy on interaction, which is what a normal class should also be like. A language teacher also said, I, as a child, always learned better when I learned via fun and doing, rather than rote. Of course, when I was a child, there was not much choice, rote being the mode. Now things have changed drastically and for the better. Curricula design is being given the attention it deserves, and content development is an art and a science. If we make learning fun and entertainment, encouraging children to explore and learn, with technology serving as a facilitator for both children and teachers, then that is an ideal situation. Of course, online classes can be exhausting to the mind and the body. Hence, correct posture, optimum number of reps, quality me time, study at your own pace models, platforms, and such have helped address the challenge of mental and physical stress to some extent. However, caution is still advised in order to strike that delicate balance. Valuable inputs such as the above are part of a quantitative and qualitative data that help improvise teaching and learning processes. And the crux of this lies in data, its collection, filtering, and extrapolation. McKinsey report says every 3 years, the OECD uses PISA, that is the Program for International Student Assessment, to test the 15-year-olds around the world on math, reading, and science. What makes these tests so powerful is that they go beyond the numbers, asking students, principals, teachers, and parents a series of questions about their attitudes, behaviors, and resources. An optional student survey on information and communications technology, ICT, asks specifically about technology use in a classroom, for homework, and more broadly. In 2018, more than 340,000 students in 51 countries took the ICT survey, providing a rich data set for analyzing key questions about technology use in schools. How much is technology being used in schools? Which technologies are having a positive impact on student outcomes? What is the optimal amount of time to spend using devices in classroom and for homework? How does this vary across different countries and regions around the world? The importance of data can be gathered from what mentioned. which goes to emphasize the importance of collection of the right kind of quality data in an efficient and non-partial and timely fashion in order to impact policymaking and implementation for the empowerment of those who hold the future. Having said, the main element remains balance, a balance between the contributions of diverse stakeholders in the education ecosystem, a balance between the application and contribution of technology and physical interaction in the domain of education, and a balance between what constitutes education and its dissemination. Though this is a thin line to walk, it is essential to execute more so now than ever before, thanks to the pandemic and the changes it has propelled around the world.
Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, U.S. President Joe Biden has addressed Americans after a surge in attacks against Asians inside of the United States. Now, he said that the U.S. is no place for hate. And that sounds like a great slogan, but if we look at the historic reality, it seems that hatred has been a consistent fiber of life for many minorities in the country.
The United States has witnessed yet another hate crime against minority groups that sparked a nationwide debate over the threats these people are facing in the country. On Wednesday, a white man gunned down 8 people, including 6 Asian women at spas around Atlanta. The incident raised fears that it might be a new wave of attacks on Asian Americans. A report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists pose the most lethal domestic terrorism threats to the U.S. It also warned that threats from domestic violent extremism are metastasizing across the country and could grow in 2021. Hate crimes against minorities in the U.S. have significantly increased over the past years, as former President Donald Trump explicitly favored white people over people of color. Many African Americans and Hispanics have been attacked or killed by white police officers or extremist groups. Asian Americans are in no better condition. They have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak, as Trump directly blamed China for the pandemic. Now the question is, how would a country whose foundation has been built on killing the minorities manage to get rid of racism, which has been entrenched in its culture for centuries?
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of Washington, D.C., senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netva Freeman, and professor at CUNY and political commentator Danny Shum out of New York. Welcome both of you to the program. Let's start this off in D.C. with Netva. What do you think is actually behind the spike in attacks that we're witnessing right now against Asians?
Well, I think most people understand that it started with a lot of the rhetoric that Donald Trump was having, and people in that of that ilk in terms of the United States, like low level of xenophobic, more the low level of political understanding and analysis, but highly xenophobic dispositions and mentality. And trying to blame, and the U.S. not really taking responsibility, for its role and the spread and proliferation of the pandemic here, and then, you know, Trump making his comments, and then people and other people, not just Trump, but other people, Kung Flu and all those kind of crazy things. But at the same time, we should not make this only about Trump, because I think here the Democrats, the Democratic Party, particularly this new administration, would love to scapegoat Trump and his role in that Trump administration and the rise of xenophobic and right-wing racist phenomenon, or not really a rise in it. It's not really more prominent than it was before, but maybe it's gotten more desperate. But we also shouldn't divorce it from the foreign policy and the angling of the United States, which is very racist foreign policy disposition toward China and Korea, and angling for war, and that in itself comes with its own propaganda. You know, Washington, the Wall Street Journal, and all of them participate in this angling. So when people have low levels of political understanding and they don't understand colonialism and how the global economy works and things like that, then they will often see as their adversaries people that are not like them, and the people who are in the eye in this kind of focus, this lens of attack. And so that's where I would start with that, is that, you know, it's generally the United States capitalist, settler, colonialist system and imperialist government that kind of sets this tone and is an incubator mm-hmm. for such backwards ideas.
Okay. Well, Danny, touching on some of the same points that Nedva has made, though, I want your perspective on how much of what we are witnessing do you think relates to what we saw take place during the Trump administration. As Nedva said, it was as far as the jargon that was used and the whole atmosphere, is it more that, or in general, that this country basically was built on racism, and there is a great racial divide that is taking place in the U.S. now?
In the words of Malcolm X, you can't have capitalism without racism. And we are fed a steady diet of xenophobic, anti-immigrant, xenophobic miseducation in this country. Unfortunately, these horrific killings in Atlanta do not come as a surprise in a country where, in the words of H. Rap Brown, racism is American as apple pie. After January 6th, with the countdown to inauguration, we were just counting how many incidents, how many high-profile incidents of anti-Asian violence would there be. And as Netflix laid out in his summation, there's this long history of anti-China, anti-socialist propaganda. We only have to check the front page every day of the Financial Times in London, in the New York Times here, and across this country. So it's not just coming from the right wing. It's coming from both wings of the ruling class. As the competition with China heats up, this is a technological and economic and diplomatic battle. So these headlines, unfortunately, are going to continue to play out, especially among the white working class, who's been fed how many centuries of white supremacy and backwardness.
Well, Nedva, what do you make of Biden's comments that the U.S. is not a country of hate? Because if we look at the U.S.'s terrible record when it comes to dealing, especially with Native and Black Americans, it's deeply rooted in hate. But your overall take on the way this administration has been addressing this issue, do you see it as being hypocritical?
Well, it's absolutely hypocritical, and what it comes at a time where actually this wing of the ruling class, which is dominated by the Democratic Party and this Biden-Harris presidency, is really doing its best to, this issue emerges when it's doing its best to play on a crude identity politics that's absent of the class struggles, that's absent of capitalism, and trying to play on, well, Black Lives Matter and other people matter, and that movement that's making them have to address what's being called racial injustice or racial justice has emerged, particularly young people who have a very internationalist purview, who are open to other peoples, and they're trying to miss, but they want that to stay there, and they don't want like what we just what we talked about here earlier with Danny mentioning, is that the United States and its capitalism is intertwined with racism, and they can't be separated. They need to separate it, and so that's what they're doing. So he has to give pronouncements, denouncing what's happening. They want to make sure we don't make the connections of those things with the foreign policy toward like North Korea and China and other places around the world. It's absolutely hypocritical. Not to mention, even if we're talking about police, they have to embrace police in spite of the fact that the overwhelming sentiment against the racial justice against the police and how racist they are as an institution. And so, you know, it's nothing but hypocrisy when he can't tease out all the rest of the interconnections and intersections of this issue.
Well, Danny, in 2020, we saw many people protest against racial inequality. What came about of those demonstrations? Has anything changed?
That's a great question. A lot of window dressing, especially from the Democrats, but institutionally, systematically, what has changed? Segregation and white supremacy and police brutality has not changed. A year ago, when Breonna Taylor was murdered, we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the brutal torture and assassination of George Floyd. But the people continue to resist, proving how true the statement is that repression breeds resistance, and only resistance can bring us our freedom. Today, across the country, as we speak, there are demonstrations against racism, against anti-Asian hatred and hate crimes. So really, it's only the people in motion with these different anti-racist and anti-imperialist organizations who can usher in a new day. It's not going to be a Joe Biden or a Kamala Harris or any other white knight from their pedestal that's going to cause any real systematic change. So I think it's correct to be in the streets, to stand with our Asian sisters and brothers across this country at this crucial moment, at this tragic historical moment.
Well, NAFTA, listen to what Danny just said. Let's talk about that possibility, talking about a rising resistance. When we look at, because you pointed out and talked about the way the U.S. is handling its foreign policy and the way it has demonized, for example, China or North Korea, and of course the way the media, the mainstream media, also promotes what the state is basically telling them. So how likely is it that we will get to that point of this rising resistance, this, if you want to say, woke group that really can make that change that's necessary?
It's interesting that you use the term woke, because the Wall Street Journal rather just had put out a thing using the term sort of more disparagingly, mm-hmm. is it the way of disparaging the xenophobia and racism and whatnot. But I think one of the things, and this is where the media is very key to the answering into your question, is that it is quite likely. One of the things, in spite of all of the megaphone, you know, they're using to put out their propaganda and their spin, is that they're not reporting on, for example, Dan mentioned a lot of the demonstrations that are going on. If we go into those demonstrations, particularly if you look at people's journalism and people's coverage, so to speak, that the internet has on social media and whatnot, we can see a lot of solidarity with these young people across race lines, quote-unquote race lines, if you will, but also recognizing the solutions that Danny talked about, that it's not within the state, and then denouncing the police. I saw one a young woman, Asian woman, who was talking about having a discussion with her mother about the role of the police, and them thinking, well, the hate crimes that are emerging against Asians in the United States means that we have to embrace the police. And she was explaining to her mother, no, the police don't keep us safe. And then she talked about the racist policies and actions and implementation of police against African people, black people in this country. And so, and you know, just if you look, if you're on the ground among the people, you can see that there's an emerging young generation that sees through this stuff. We just don't get, it doesn't get reported. As long as we're also using mobilizations to engage in organization with political education, then it's inevitable. This system is crumbling, and the contradiction of the system cannot be hidden. I mean, they can do a good job of making it look like it's hidden, but it's not really hidden from the people who have to face the consequences of it.
Well, Danny, in a report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, it says the biggest threat to the United States is racially motivated domestic terrorism. Your take on this assessment?
Yeah, no question. I mean, even the FBI in the state has recognized this, yet here we have this assassin, this racist murderer, killed 8 people, and the police apprehend him peacefully. He doesn't have a scratch on him. So we see, whether it's Dylann Roof or this other young man, these are deeply sick individuals, infected with how many decades and centuries of the white supremacy, and then the police handle them with kids' gloves. I think it's important to continue to take these big steps back and contextualize internationally how fearful this decaying empire is of China, of China's $1 trillion investment in other countries across Latin America, the new accords with Australia, with Japan, with other Asian powers. We remember Obama's pivot to Asia, so quote-unquote away from the war on terrorism. So it's within this context that we see these attacks on China, as if China were somehow our existential threat here in New York City and D.C. and beyond, when it's probably the coronavirus, lack of health care. But you cannot have war without racist demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. So that's the context that really puts whether somebody is Southeast Asian or Vietnamese or Filipino, they fall into this category of a people who's being branded as this internal enemy. So if we don't have that context, then we're going to believe the MSNBC and CNN headlines that these are just individual racist attacks, when in fact it's part of something much bigger.
What about that, NETFA, what Danny just said about that demonization? And he was talking, of course, on an international level, but even locally. I mean, if we look at what's happening inside the states, there are some analysts who talks about that this technique that is being used is the divide and conquer, divide the people, divide them into racists, divide them into whatever you can divide them into, in order that they cannot unite and actually really make a change in the system. What do you think about that side of things?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's absolutely true. You can't have it without having even domestic, propaganda to confuse people. In fact, I alluded a couple times to this Washington Wall Street Journal article that talked about what it was doing was demonizing language and woke, saying, accusing China and a media thing of using woke language, as it said, to confuse, create racial tensions in the United States and animosity, as if there's not racism here already. And a way of saying that social justice movements are being influenced by outside agitators is that whole trope that's longstanding in the United States. Just like they did with, they did the same thing with Russia, and saying these little insignificant social media posts were aggravating tensions in the United States, as opposed to the actual real root problem itself being the cause of the unrest here. And so what is that? That's to divide us, to create some attempt, and I will say it's a feeble attempt. I don't think it will work, but a feeble attempt to accuse those of us who are on the ground talking about racial justice of being influenced by something else, and not having the intelligence to know the difference between what really ails us and afflicts us, as opposed to these other messages, so-called messages that are supposed to be coming from somewhere else.
Well, Danny, your take, how do you see the future in the United States? Because you talked about these growing movements and these demonstrations and more young people having more of an international perspective. Do you see the future, basically, the pendulum swinging as far as the amount of people who are aware and being able to make a change in that system? Or do you see the system just crumbling, basically, because it won't make the changes that these young people and others are demanding?
Yeah, a study showed that 43% of young people in the U.S. look favorably upon socialism. I think there's more and more international solidarity every day with different struggles in the global south, whether it's in Haiti, or in Nicaragua, and Cuba, and Venezuela. One-third to one-fourth of humanity lives under the suffocating sanctions of the empire. So it is upon us for the pendulum to swing. It won't be delivered by UPS or from on high, from without. It is incumbent upon us to organize this movement through popular education, to oppose it every moment, ruling class ideology, all of the ugliness and backwardness and white supremacy that seeps through this miseducational system, this mainstream corporate media. So there's a lot of work in front of us, and how important for everyone out there to join an organization, join study groups, and to be a part of this history, because all of humanity and the future of the planet depends upon it.
Nat, for your take, what do you think it's going to take to bring about the necessary change in that country?
You mean in the U.S.?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with exactly what Danny said, and I think it's that the most impacted, the most people that are facing the most disparaging impacts of this system, unjust capitalist racist system, need to be organized, and the particularly working class people of non-white working class need to be at the lead of that struggle, making unity with the broader working class in the United States. And then we also, I'll just say this, is we also have to, they're doing their best in the previous example that we mentioned, doing their best to disparage other forms of media information, because they're not, it's a desperate attempt, because they know people are realizing they can't depend on these corporate forms of information, so they want to disparage other ones. So, you know, like we mentioned, the Wall Street Journal's attempt. So we have to be able to look at other outlets like this one, like the media outlet right here. None of these corporate things will have Danny or I on here or anybody else talking about this topic the way we're talking about it. And so we have to look for other forms of information. And like Danny said, we also have to engage in collective popular education, political education, not just consuming the information, but getting together so we can have an interpretation of the information that we're getting to inform our organizing.
Thank you both for being with us on this debate. Senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netfa Freeman out of Washington, D.C., and Professor Ed Cooney and political commentator Danny Shaw.